Let's say our opening prayer. O Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Beloved Jesus Christ, Blessed Master, Dearest Mother, Beloved David, Saints and Sages of all religions, I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles, and give me physical, mental, and spiritual development. Make my mind thy temple. Make my heart thy altar. Make my love thy home. Be thou the only king, reigning on the throne of my consciousness. Om. Peace, bliss, amen. You know, I was thinking the other day how Mother always said an opening prayer and a closing prayer. And it was a formula. She always did things in sequence and in a certain way. And I realized that the words in the prayer are very meaningful, but the fact that the prayer was always there conditions the mind to prepare for a talk. And once you have one good experience with one of Mother's talks and it goes in a certain way and you see that being repeated time and again, tends to just open the door in your own mind and break down some resistance and makes you feel relaxed. And I was thinking how Mother devotedly and always, and David too, always said opening and closing prayers. So I'll tell you an odd thing that happened when we started doing, Kate and I started doing talks of Mother's, recorded talks of Mother's. And, we had not done it for a while, and before that, we were all up at David's place. And he started through his Dark Night of the Soul. And so I think it was maybe 6 months or a year before we started doing it. Kate might remember better. But Herwin came, and at that time, I was just wanting to listen to a talk to Mother. And Mother often had an opening prayer, but most of her tapes do not have an opening prayer. And I would just start it from scratch. And we didn't listen to music either. I was just making the tapes available. That's what was in my mind. And and Herwin said, Larry, you have to say open prayer. This doesn't feel right if you don't. And so I took that to heart. It had a big effect on me. Because it wasn't, with Herwin, it was not a criticism. It wasn't voiced or, cast as a criticism at all. He was speaking for Mother. So I have a very short meditation, and because I don't have my own computer here or I don't have it ready, I'm going to play this. So if you guys would all mute, it'd probably play better than otherwise. Tell me if you can hear this and we can meditate for a few minutes. Kate, if you could start reading and pick up on chapter 7. If you know the spot where Jill left off, please.
Yes, so this is chapter 7, as Larry said, just entitled simply Crucifixion. The Savior is going to be crucified. He predicts that he must die. He predicts that he must die because he knows that until the humanness within him is crucified or transformed, he can never come into the full glory of his sonship with God. He can never rise into the heaven of his own being. So he knows that this is true. You are going through this tremendous ordeal, and as you go through the ordeal of carrying your cross up to the hill of Golgotha, you, like the Christ, stumble and fall time after time, because you can always get the direction of God. And so you fall, and your cross must be picked up for you by Simon, in quotes, that one which knows the truth and says, "My son, you made a mistake. Come, I will carry your cross for you until you can find your way again. I will be your light." And so you pick up your cross and you start again. And then again, like the Christ, you fall. And this is the way it is on the road to Calvary, on the road to the hill of Golgotha, the place of the skull, which is what Golgotha means. This is where Christ within you is crucified, on the Mount of Olives, right where the life force enters the body, the two eyes on the Mount of Olives. This is all symbolic, but this is the true meaning. Jesus said, I came not to bring peace, but a sword. This consciousness works in the world of duality. That's why it's a sword. It has two sides to it. It has a positive and a negative side. And that force enters the body at the medulla. It goes straight through to the point of Christ consciousness, the optic thalamus gland, and it stimulates the pineal gland, because that's the spiritual gland which takes you into the heaven of your own being. It is only when you're able to do this, when you can see this great light, that you know the true meaning of the psalm when it says, "I will guide and direct thee with mine eye." Not eyes, not two of them, but one, that spiritual eye. We must realize that the Bible and every scripture in the world is written in parables. And when it comes time for you to expand your consciousness to realize the higher truths, then God will make it possible for you to know the true meaning of it. The 14 stations of the cross are the 7 spinal centers with the positive and negative forces in each one of them. The 3 lower centers are the ones in which the human consciousness is very firmly embedded, and so the release of the consciousness from those 3 lower ones is the tough one. That's the one you really have the experiences with. But then, having come to this heart center, which is a battlefield because it's the neutral ground between the 3 lower ones and the 3 upper ones where the consciousness must climb, so the soul reaches the heart center, and there takes place the Battle of Armageddon. The Hindus call it the Battle of Kurukshetra. You will remember that Kundalini, or the serpent force, is coiled at the base of the spine. And as the devotion of your heart grows and as your consciousness expands, that force starts to rise up what the Hindus call the Sushumna passage. It's an empty passageway. And as it comes to every single one of the spinal centers, you enter into a different plane of consciousness. But you have the positive and the negative currents within yourself. The forces of good and evil are the good and bad thieves that are spoken about in allegory in the scriptures. Now, as this force rises, there is a tremendous burning sensation in the body, and sometimes you maintain it for a long time afterwards. Indeed, when man goes through that experience, he wears a crown of thorns upon his head, because that serpent force is like a coiled electrical force that rises in the spine and sets the whole body on fire. Then it burns the brain, and that burning is for purification. That which made you sin must be burned up. It must be purified. The dross must go, and you must have again that state of total innocence. Christians down through the ages have taken it that the cross was a wooden cross, and that Jesus was nailed with whatever types of nails they used, and that the blood ran down from his hands and his forehead because of the crown of thorns and the piercing in his side. This piercing actually happens when you, your, excuse me, this Piercing actually happens within yourself when the consciousness is going to be released from the physical body of the five senses and transferred to the electrical body, the psychic body, or the astral body, as it is called. And it is a very, very painful process. The baptism of blood comes into effect. This is not that you are baptized outwardly in blood, but that actually you shed your blood. The Savior within you sheds his blood on your cross, which is your body, in order that this transition might take place. This is the first step, you see, in the total crucifixion and the transformation from the human ego to the divine. And then this is a new section. There were two thieves, one on each side of the cross with him, and these thieves have come down in history. The two thieves on your cross are the forces of good and evil within yourself. It is the good thief, or the magnetic force, which wants to go to paradise with the Christ. And it is the negative force, the projecting force, that which opposes, that wants to keep you from going to God. The bad thief, the one who is constantly tempting him, trying to keep him from going to God, is cursing. He's saying to himself, why can he not save us? If you be God, then save us. But the good thief reasons with him. He says, no, what we are getting we have earned, but this good man, he has done nothing. And then he turned to the Christ and he said, I would like to be with you in paradise. And Jesus said to him, today you shall be with me in paradise. Because he knew that this good force within himself, that magnetic force which was constantly trying to inspire him to seek God, that one would go with him. These two forces working together, one the magnetic force going to God, and the other the opposing force, trying to keep the soul from going to God, work equally. And the higher one goes, the higher the other one goes. Both these forces are necessary. But even the good one is a thief, because it keeps you from total realization of your oneness with God. As long as there is a state of duality, there is a thief on your cross. The opposition is necessary in order that you may go beyond it into God's paradise, into the oneness, the realization of your oneness with him. This is an absolute necessity. I can tell you intimately every tiny detail, the experiences I went through as these two thieves fought on my own cross for their ascendancy. The two of them fought over me, and all I could do was to hang on to God alone because the experience was so tremendous, so tremendous. At one moment, I would descend into the depths of hell of my own being. I would see all of the former incarnations. It was as though I saw people coming up from the dead, as though in truth the graves were opening up and the people were coming forth. And as the experience went on, and this is written about in the scriptures in India and in many of their books over there, the disciple, the devotee, is made to utter sounds, is made to move the body, which they call there the cosmic dance or the dance of Shiva. You hear the cries of those who are suffering. It's as though they were in a tunnel. I'm recalling this now from the experience which I went through, and it's as though some of them were on fire, as though they were burning. And then, again, you are lifted up into the heights, and you're taken up into the superconscious state, and God gives you great revelations. You are between these two forces, one taking you down into the subconscious mind, the hell of your own being. That's the descension into hell. And the other one trying to lift you up to heaven. And strangely enough, the things which were given to me in Revelation have come true right to the last tiny word and detail. Every day of my life, I sit in awe and wonder at the glory of God and the things which he has put me through, the things which I have experienced, the truth which I have realized within my own being. When Jesus said, unless you pick up your cross and follow me, you cannot be my disciple, it is the truth. What is your cross? Does anyone carry around a wooden cross, just ready to pick it up and put it on his back and follow Christ? Is that what is meant? No, this is my cross right here, with my arms outstretched and my feet together. This is the cross that I must pick up and follow the Christ, which means to emulate him in every detail if I am to be his disciple. And this I wanted more than I wanted my life. Yet having gone through this experience, I have my life. I have it. Strangely enough, the two thieves afterwards, both of their legs were broken. That meant that both of the forces of good and evil within the body of Jesus, were both broken. These legs were broken because when you have paid the final price of crucifixion, when you have crucified this human ego so that it may be transformed into the divine, then the power of the two thieves has left. They have no power whatsoever. But you will notice that it is very specific in saying that the legs of Jesus were not broken. Why is that? Because he is going to take over the kingdom, and he is the eternal spirit within. The two thieves and the cross are part of delusion, a part of the human ego consciousness. But the Christ in you is God himself in human form. And so when God in you, in human form, goes through the state of transition, it is not necessary to break him, because he is going to continue on. Actually, this is when the Christ is born, and he's going to take over the kingdom. He's going to take over the kingdom, and there's going to be nothing but God in you. It's the end.
Kate, would you do me a favor and would you read the foreword that I wrote? It hasn't been
read. Just today, the one for the book?
That's right.
Okay. I will have to find it, so just hang on a few minutes. Larry, maybe while I'm finding it, you can tell the people what the new book is about.
So I think people do know we're doing a new book on Mother.
Not everybody does, no.
And it's a book that is all about Papa, and that's because of Papa's 100th anniversary, of course. We're going to be at the ashram, and we're going to have the book printed in India, and we'll give out copies there. And it's about the first meeting with Papa. Mother's, she's wrote a thing for the Vision magazine called God Comes to Visit, in which she talks about the first time she met Papa and him coming to her house. And so we have the talk that Papa gave at Mother's house. And in it was taken down by Swami Satchidananda, and it was Kate found it in Ram Dass Speaks, a book that the ashram publishes. And then the core of the book is the wonderful sections towards the end of the Gospel of Swami Ram Dass that cover Mother's and Father's trip there and the wonderful conversations they had. That's what inspired us, is that Kate had asked Swamiji, or I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Kate, but asked if she could take out all the sections. It was something David and I talked about too, with the three of us had talked about.
Swami Satchidananda, that was way back in 2003 or 4 when I was there.
And you got permission to take out the sections of, I thought it was a good idea to get those sections taken out with no intention, just to have it available for devotees perhaps. But it was.
I think we intended to publish it at that point.
At some point. This has turned out to be at a very, spectacular time. And it's also been improved upon considerably by Kate's additions that she's made. So there's more to come, more information about that. But I think what we just read about the crucifixion, that the forward. Now, let me say this too, that the book that we're writing here, that, and Kate's doing as usual, most of the work, is to do with the, not the happy part, but it certainly was happy for Mother. The parts of first meeting Papa and first, coming to the ashram and all of those really wonderful, because this was this tremendous preparation that Papa put her through. And then the book ends with Mother giving a talk in 1968 to the Hyderabad devotees of Papa's, and talking effusively, of course, about him. So it's just all about Papa. It's something that we've kind of always wanted to do. And we're going to do a book on all many saints that Mother met, and we'll probably include this some of the same stuff again, but there's much more, many more letters and much more to, of the story of Papa. But this one is really just the preparatory, the very much the honeymoon time for, I mean, Mother didn't take him as a guru, but as her own guru, but she certainly had a wonderful, wonderful time at the beginning. And then, of course, she went through the crucifixion there under his guidance. But go ahead, Kate, if you've got it available.
Yeah, so I guess just to explain a bit more is that because of the celebratory time that's coming up here, and because we'd already had put the mystical crucifixion together, we didn't want to dwell on that at all. So it's strictly that wonderful time of Mother being with Papa for this celebration. But Larry has in his foreword, which he's just completed, he kind of goes into some of the description of everything that Mother went, or of things that Mother went through.
I think it's important because it shows why Papa was so important to her. It's not just meeting a saint. This is a significant meeting, and that's why this particular book is just about the joy and the anticipation that Mother is going through. But I did the foreword, and it wasn't the way I intended to write it at all. It just came in the way that you'll hear. But it is to revisit some of the reasons Mother found him so absolutely compelling. She was just, when she had her own master to compare to, she knew what divinity was. And so, go ahead, Kate.
Mm-hmm. And Larry would, and I would welcome your feedback on it because it's still evolving a little bit. When Mother Hamilton first met Swami Ramdas, Papa, in parentheses, in a suite at the Meany Hotel in Seattle, her first glimpse from the open doorway was Papa's delighted expression and him clasping his hands over his head in a sign of victory. The notion of victory was quite significant in Papa's practice and teachings because his constantly chanted mantra was Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. Jai translates as victory, and Ram in this context is translated as God. Thus, the victory that Papa saw in Mother's appearance can only be taken as his recognition that Mother was victorious, or that Ram was victorious in her. But she didn't know any of that at the time, and she was about to immerse herself into the spiritually dynamic world in which Papa lived and worked. Mother found that Papa was very different in expression from her own master, Paramahansa Yogananda, but she found in Papa a divine personality, like she knew from that previous divine contact. Yogananda taught his disciples to seek out saints, to spend time in their presence, and that this will benefit their progress on the spiritual path. He was known as an expert on saints of all types and levels of attainment. Paramahansa Yogananda knew of Swami Ramdas from letters that were exchanged between him and Swami Satchinanda. Swami Satchinanda visited Anandashram in 1942. In 1955, Satchinanda wrote an article in the ashram's publication titled Silver Jubilee's Souvenir of Mother Krishnabai's Renunciation. We also know that Papa knew about Yogananda. I presume this because of Swami Satchinanda's visit, and also that there are stories of SRF devotees after Master's passing asking Papa to take them as a disciple and Papa refusing, saying, I am not your guru, Yogananda is your guru. This didn't happen with Mother Hamilton, as she didn't ask him to be Papa's disciple, but rather she asked him for help in getting through the final steps in her path towards God realization. There are many stories in India of disciples seeking help from another saint, usually after the guru has passed. Meher Baba was initiated by Hazrat Babajan and later turned to Upasni Maharaj to attain his final liberation. Many self-realization fellowship devotees visited Anandamoyi Ma, and many were helped by her. Papa's father was his guru, and it was from him that he received the holy mantra Om Shri Ram Jai Ram Jai Jai Ram. But during his early days of sadhana, starting on December 27, 1922, he visited Ramana Maharshi and prayed for his blessing. And behold, he was granted a great boon that brought him the universal vision. Papa played a key role in Mother's development. She needed protection, encouragement, and advice. The protection came in his invitation to come and stay at Anandashram in 1957 through 1958. This was critical, as it turned out, because Mother went through a severe and universal crucifixion-like experience at the ashram when Papa launched her into the final Kundalini process. She had undergone much of this before traveling to the ashram, and God so arranged it that she went through the most difficult and the most painful part under Papa's guidance and protection. This is described in great detail in her book, The Mystical Crucifixion, published by the Cross and Lotus Publishing in early 2022. Mother's stay at the ashram started on October 14, 1957, and Papa was available every day. She often talked about this extraordinary fact, that Papa could maintain his Sahaja Samadhi state throughout the day and night. He was always open to receiving people, and he never had days off or of withdrawal. Mother mentioned this many times and how it really spoke to his state of realization. Papa was established in the highest of states, and it manifested itself as sometimes quite severe. Mother told us that Papa gave her no quarter as she was going through the difficulties of extreme Kundalini heat and mental duress that accompanied her latter months at the ashram in 1958. This characteristic is a defining element in the story of what a fully realized God-man is, complete dispassion that is a result of his actionless inner state amidst the outer state of action. Papa spent the early months stabilizing Mother and steering her mind to think more and more of God and his attributes. This resulted in Mother slowly understanding just what is asked of a person on the final mile up to the spiritual mountain, up the ladder of cosmic consciousness. After a few months, she started to experience a restlessness, and she mentioned this to Papa. He suggested that she travel a bit, perhaps to get some perspective on this demands of spiritual development. Papa knew that the ego was feeling cornered, that Mother's true self was starting to take control, and these two competing selves were having a tug of war between them. Mother talked a lot about this feature on the spiritual path, that of being torn between the two forces. So in late December and early January of 1958, I think it's more mid-January, Larry, she and Father traveled to Raman Ashram, which she found to be a very disappointing and downgraded since the time of Ramana Maharshi living there. They also traveled to Madras, Chennai, and to St. Thomas the Apostle Basilica. Mother visited St. Tom two other times, and it was clear from the photos of her visits this place meant a lot to her. She never discussed why she felt this way, but there are several photos that Mother brought back from her 1968 and 1977 trips that show her holding the lance that killed St. Thomas, and one that shows her holding the reliquary containing relics of St. Thomas's body. After they returned to the ashram, then Mother was put back to work and unknowingly continued to prepare for the great ordeal that she was to undergo while there. Mother experienced a schizophrenic-like mental state during that latter time, and this recurred a few times over the next 2 years. After her return to America, she was still very much caught between the two forces, and she was confused by these extreme and dramatic swings in her moods and emotions. In 1960, Mother grew in understanding and found that she was over the worst of physical and mental experiences. This is when she started to see just what it was that Papa had done for her. He protected her during the worst of her Kundalini experiences by not letting her be given drugs nor put away in a hospital or sanatorium. She lamented how little Western medicine knew about such things and their inability to treat some highly advanced souls in their care who are going through what are, at root, spiritual growth and development. Many Christian saints have similar stories of this kind. They experience severe pain and mental duress, emotional imbalance, and great suffering. Sri Ramakrishna also had very difficult things to endure, and he was very badly treated by people who didn't understand what he was going through. Meher Baba used to hit his head against a wall due to the difficulties that he experienced. Papa once said that one of Mother's particularly difficult experiences at the ashram in 1957, once said after one of Mother's particularly difficult experiences at the ashram in 1957, that he stood at the door with a club and warded off death. When I knew Mother from 1976 on, she was very full of praise for Papa, that we all were transported into a great love for him. She taught from the deep wells of wisdom that she had drawn from her own master and from Papa. She initiated us into Yogananda's Kriya Yoga, and she taught us the Ram Mantra from Papa. She always said that she was the result of two masters. Master brought her to the point that she had learned to know and love God above all things in life. This is the great and necessary gift that will take one through all of the things on the path. This precious gift endows us with endurance and strength. Without this preparation, she could never have withstood and triumphed over the trials that came during her mystical crucifixion under Papa.
That's amazing, Larry. Thank you so, so much. There's so many things you said that I never heard before. I'm just thrilled to hear this. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Well, here's it. I'm not going to have this in the book because it doesn't fit. But there was a letter. I just wanted to mention this because it came to me. There's a letter that Mother sent to Herwin talking about when she said to Papa that they thought about traveling and they're going to go to a few different places. And Papa said, Ram Dass is not really for it. He doesn't think you should go that long. And then he finally agreed, well, they can go to Thiruvannamalai and to Madras. But then he said, and Mother told Herwin only, she didn't say this in any public way, Papa said, having the two of you here brings the whole state in the ashram up. It elevates everybody. And then Ram Dass himself is in that, just kind of creates the whole atmosphere that all the ashram was benefiting from them being here by the questions they were asking, by what it brought forth in Papa. And so that's what she told her. Well, that's very interesting.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And we have that other quote you found that we're putting in the book too. There are two things. One is that Mother's experience of being with him under the starry sky, and the effulgence from Papa's body pouring out over all the people. But the other one is more interesting, is that all of the ashramites loved it when, or expected Mother or Father to ask questions when they all got together, because that's what it brought out so much in Papa. So I remember people talking about David that way with Swamiji, that they'd like to have him there because Swamiji would talk more and it would be interesting conversation. Well, I think, you know, to have someone as great as Yogananda, the great master and the great connection to the lineage in India that we get through him, and Papa's greatness, Mother had these two forces that were willing to help her in this lifetime. And the notion that she often said that it was a universal experience really is proven by the people who helped her, for sure, that she had something great to go through and something difficult to go through, and they were there to help.
Larry, I have a question that came to me as Kate was reading that forward. And I could go look this up, but I'm just asking for simple, because you're here. So is Yogananda older than Papa?
No, Papa's older.
Okay, that's what I thought. So, but Yogananda, had he already passed away when Mother went to the ashram?
Yes. Yes, in fact, 6 years before.
Okay. Yeah, I just didn't know how that... I mean, I always thought that, and then it just came to me, well, yeah. I was thinking Papa was older, but I know Yogananda wasn't that old when he passed away, but... Okay, thank you.
Yeah, Papa was born in 1888. Well, four, was it? Eight, I forget. Anyway, you know, he was several years older than Master, and lived longer, too, so... It kind of reminds us of our David. He should be here for another 30 years.
Yeah.
It is interesting, though, that just from that point of view, that Mother, that David did pass at his early age, and Mother himself lived until he was 6. And then I meant to say, it's interesting too, Master David was 59 when he passed.
Barry, you're breaking up really badly.
No, we can't hear you at all now, Larry.
It's really distorted. Nothing.
Larry, let's check to see if it's a broadband connection. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
You're both very, very distorted.
You better mute yourself, Larry. You better mute yourself. Let Jill take over.
Yeah. Both Peter and Larry are. Try it now, Larry.
Kate, didn't you say once that you, I think it was you that, or maybe it was Jill that said you had a problem if somebody else was in the house was on Zoom at the same time? Didn't you say that sometimes caused an interference?
It had been, and we have to make sure we have the doors closed, so I don't know how far away Peter and Larry are.
It didn't have to do with the bandwidth.
I'm in a different room.
It's better now.
You're fine now, Peter.
How about
you're
me?
Fine, you're fine.
So maybe it was the website, connection here to the house.
Okay. I think the broadband went out for a little bit.
Okay. Yeah, I got a funny message, and it happened right when I moved the camera. I'm not sure what was going on. So let's try to stay on topic with the crucifixion. Kate, would you remind us what you read, the details from, that's probably why we should always speak immediately afterwards and then have these diversions that I'm prone to at another time.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got into the first it was the Hill of Golgotha and Jesus falling and then the three showing about the three lower forces, lower centers, and then the crucifixion is the neutral center and where the battlefield is, and then the three upper centers.
That's right.
And then she's kind of gone through some of the same things about Kundalini that we had before. Mm-hmm. And then go into the two thieves.
Okay. So, I remember now, what I was thinking. So when Mother talks about this battleground of the heart level, that's the Battle of Kurukshetra, because this is important to me, and I think it should be to all of this kind of great understanding of the symbols behind and the symbolism and the allegory behind the great scriptures. And there's no doubt that the Battle of Kurukshetra is the battle of the heart center. It's the Kundalini rising to the heart center and the battle that goes on there. There's a number of things we can talk about there. I think the thieves are very, very interesting. And the story with Vyasa, who is the who's writing it, is there's one story anyway that it was Ganesha too, wasn't it? Anyone else know the details there? But anyway, Ganesha has always a broken tusk, and that's to show the breaking of duality, to have one of his tusks broken. That's a key feature, that to break duality, to steer the mind to show us that we must get beyond duality to get to the highest state. The whole point of this is to get to the point where we cannot fall, from which we cannot fall. Mother talked about this a lot, that Sahaja Samadhi is a state from which you cannot fall. Now, that sounds a strange thing to say, because we think, well, gee, everyone who has any ego is going to say that, you know, that you can benefit from being around me because I'm just so superb, and I'm above the law. So these are dangerous things, but they are also true for some people. So if you can hook your wagon to the right star here, you can travel with these great, great masters by knowing these people cannot fall, that they're only here for the benefit of the disciples who are under them. So there's so little risk with being with Mother. You never felt invaded. And all the masters that I've met all have that characteristic. That, you know, and I lived with David and knew David very, very well. And I knew him before he'd gone through and he developed. Towards the end of his life, he just simply had nothing but, you can felt completely safe with him. Yeah. He had only an uplifting effect on you. So that's really a mark of his attainment. Certainly Swami Sachidananda. And I wrote it in 1998 by Bob Raymer. So whether he was fully realized or not, we don't know. He could easily have been, and I don't mean to disparage him, we just don't know enough about his life, and we don't get to judge anyway. But his being in his presence and in Yogacharya Black's presence, you felt, no matter, even if it was critical things, you never felt anything but benefit and being lifted up. This is just absolutely the truth. Mother taught that, but it is absolutely the truth, is where you can feel safe. I know that Mother felt that with Papa. She had to. So the Battle of Kurukshetra and the Battle of Armageddon are at the heart center. And they're still, so another thing that Mother did teach about this is that the three, does Jesus fall three times? I forget. But she, at any rate, she said each fall represents the next stage. Because remember, Jesus is going to Golgotha. Now, Golgotha is in the skull, and the heart center is in the torso. So what's going on here? Well, these things get complicated, and the crucifixion occurs at the heart center, perhaps at the Garden of Gethsemane, for the physical body. And then it's depicted, because it is a crucifixion, it's depicted at the throat center, and it would be depicted at the sixth center, when he went over the top. And that happens inside the skull, within the skull. So the times that Jesus falls, these are depicting what this path is all about. But she said that these are the falls represent the preparation and getting ready to move into the next higher chakra. I remember that distinctly in the early days. And I do know that this stuff is not linear. It's not something that makes a lot of sense because we are trained to think of this Kundalini experience, by the way, as being linear. And it may not be, depending on what you've gone through in other lifetimes anyway. But the house of the skull, or the place of the skull, the Golgotha, is to show the final emancipation, where duality is finally broken. There's still dual nature. After the heart center, you're still in a dual body. And then after the throat center also. And you only get out away from duality after going into the seventh chakra.
Well, something that I noted when we were compiling the book and wanted to have in the book, because I may be wrong, but I didn't remember Mother saying this every time. She always talked about the body's the cross and you stand this way. And she talked about the two thieves, and the good thief and the bad thief. But what I hadn't focused on was that, and of course you just kind of said it in a sense, is that that two forces, the good and the bad, go with you all the way until the end.
My mother said that, yeah.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's, I think, a really important part of that two thief story is that you have those both those forces all the way until the, well, and he says the one thief goes into paradise, but then mother says they both have to go. So does the thief get into paradise? I don't know, because they both have to be done away with.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, that occurred to me as you were reading it, that is that he's clearly saying, mother's clearly saying that the thief doesn't go to heaven. But, you know, at any rate, there's different levels of heaven, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And if the thief is a witness aspect, it does go with her, with Jesus. And at any rate, the thing is, the ego is gone, so the dual nature is gone. And to say it went into heaven is like saying going into a state of nirvana. Nirvana is often said to be a state of nothingness and somethingness. I think Buddha is the one who said that nirvana is not a state of nothingness. He tried to straighten that out. But it is not a state of somethingness either. It is neither something nor nothing. And that's it. These are things, you know, I still think an analogy that's so wonderful to give you an idea to understand why it's so seems to be strange talk. When people talk about the higher planes, there's a Chinese saying that, you know, the tongs that you use to pick up food that the Chinese would, you know, used early on. And we know from that they, in terms of utensils, use chopsticks, but they also use tongs. I'm sure Westerners did too, but they said that the mind is like a pair of tongs. It can go out and pick things up. But one thing, and you can examine things, and it's a wonderful tool. But one thing it can never pick up is itself. It will never be able to understand itself. It will never be able to analyze or comprehend itself. It's simply like a set of tongs, incapable by design. And so, we tend to use the mind. It's very functional and very useful. But there's a point where we just have to let the mind go and stop worrying about that and immerse in God, in the world that God gives us at the higher plane. And sometimes that's not easy to do. There's so many doubts and so much questioning going on. Why can't the tongs pick themselves up? Because they're being held by the true self, the capital self.
Oh, Larry, I have a question. So you're saying that. The mind is what thinks of the questions, but I did want to ask you, more about what Kate was saying about the oppositional force, because in the previous chapter that we read, Mother said the higher you go, the higher up you go, the greater is the opposition. And in another place she says, you need that total opposition in order to have total realization.
Yeah.
And then what Kate was saying, that the two forces go up with you all the way until you go over the top. So that ongoing battle between the two forces, the one good thief and bad thief, I just wondered if you could just talk about either your anything that comes to mind from your experiences of just how to stay in the battle, how I remember too. I think Larry, at one time, I thought I heard you say that the resistance gets less the higher up you go.
Well,
about
one thing Mother says is it becomes more subtle, certainly. So that seems in opposition to what Mother said, that resistance gets less. But the Let's. Well, I think if what
subtle is subtle is very different than less.
Well, I mean, because Mother needed to be with Papa for the what she was going through, and she didn't for the latter part. So because it's such a crisis state that the resistance might be very, very high, and that may have been what I was talking about. Because the other states, she can go. First of all, they're all within. They move more within, and they're more subtle, so therefore they don't show themselves as somebody like Mother was, you know, yelling across the ashram grounds for Lingpa to come and help her or something like that. Because Lingpa talked about that when we interviewed him, that he would go running whenever whenever Mother's voice would raise high enough that she would call for him. So that's obviously a great duress. It's all out, it's very much an outward expression. It has an outward component. The other higher things are much more within and don't show as easily. And certainly the last one, as we saw with David, I mean, he was completely invisible to me. So, you know, in his latter years, and exactly when he crossed over just is not clear at all. And he never talked about it, and I never asked him, and maybe some of you did, but it maybe wasn't clear to him either, by the way. All hidden. And not needing going to a sanatorium or a mental hospital or a hospital of any kind and getting needing drugs or help, but rather much more subtle and much more, but still a great deal of confusion. So if I said resistance, yeah, it can't match Mother's explanation, which says that it gets more difficult as you go on.
Yeah, when I was listening to that reading, I could have heard this wrong, but it sounded like as the good grows or becomes more there, I don't know the right, but then that the oppositional force grows along with it almost.
Right.
So yeah.
Well, but yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? That you need both to get to make progress or to it's or it's part of the experience.
In the balance, they have to be the same.
Yeah.
In duality, they have to. Yeah. They have to.
You can't steer a boat. You can't steer a boat to the left or to the right. You have to steer it straight down the middle, and that's the balance of forces for sure. But it's also an indication that you're in the physical realm. You're in the realm of manifestation or duality, and so. It has to be balanced. It does make sense, doesn't it? The thing is, the good thief does point the direction. And so we go up. So as an example, it's pointing the direction, so you move in that direction, but you immediately have a counter force, too, that's opposing it. You know, what occurred to me in writing that forward is that Mother's experience was that she... I forget what it was that I said. I can't remember the sentence. I'll have to. I'm sorry. Go ahead. And any other questions or things? Go ahead and think. It'll come to me, I'm sure.
Well, thank you. That does help to think of it as a balance. What Jill and Kathy said, that helps a lot. And I love the foreword that you wrote. And I love that you said when Mother was restless at the ashram, that there was that it was that battle going on inside of her.
That's what. Thank you. That you reminded me of what I was going to say, isn't it? That's what I was thinking. Is that she was Papa was aware in my mind. This is just surmise on my part, but that God was certainly aware that she. What was happening was Mother was the one self was getting the upper hand, the one getting the control, and the ego still is a. You know, in the Mahabharata, I've talked about him before, there's Bhishma. And Bhishma represents the ego, the lower self. But he's a great, powerful, he's the first person born. He's the first and oldest human in the world. And he's given a boon that he cannot be killed unless he allows it himself. He wills it himself or allows it. So he was in a battlefield. He was very fierce and No one could beat him. So that giving up, that getting to that state where Bhishma says in the battlefield, I will fight no more. And then he's allowed to. And interestingly, he was pierced with arrows. So more piercing going on. I find this significant, that piercing of Jesus' hands, and stigmata, and all of those things too. But that Bhishma, the death of the ego in the Mahabharata, is done by piercing the body and letting out the blood. So what Mother may have been going through was this restlessness where, you know, the ego that we don't think of the ego as really being the 666 or the devil. We really don't. And because we're so close to it, it is us, you know, we think. It's a false self, but we have an affection for it. We have, and that's what I love about the Mahabharata, because the Bhishma is considered a great warrior and a great teacher. He's in the wrong family. He's in the Kurava, one of the Kuru families. And they're right on the battlefield against these two families, cousins really fighting on the battlefield, all from the same family tree. So I think there is an idea that, well, gee, I can get through this and maintain who I am. And I really think that person, you know, that part of me, the ego, whatever, has something to offer. But when you're around Papa long enough, this is what came clear to me, that he was slowly presenting her with what she was asking for. He wasn't dropping it on her. He was letting it dawn on her. It made her restless because she knew this was, or she maybe didn't know how it was going to get through this, but she could see the impending doom of her life as a human being. And there's naturally resistance and puzzlement about that. And then, to Mother's credit, she didn't go home. She came back. Restless or not. And submitted to what Papa gave her.
It occurs to me while I'm reading this and hearing Kate read it as well that the ego is delivering its own self to the crucifixion, and it's required. That it is its full self, and the lower nature and the thieves on the cross and the ones who put him on the cross, all of it is the ego nature, and the crucifixion could not occur without that, the full deliverance of the ego by the ego. And what a setup for a battle.
Oh, exactly. It's such a, see, in a way, as I think about it, as you're saying it that way, it's a battle between the horizontal and the vertical of the cross. The horizontal, there's nothing wrong with living a life of the ego. It's what God created this world for. Papa says world is God. And God wouldn't have created this world as a mistake. It's a legitimate place to be. And there's a lot of effort put into creating this world. And there's a lot of effort put into being a human being in this realm. But that's different. The goals in that horizontal plane that we spend all of our life for are just not the same thing that what we're asking. When we ask for realization from a master, we are really on dangerous ground. We are really asking for something. And I think that Mother, it dawned on her slowly. Papa showed her what was expected. But it was because she was slowly aligning that horizontal life, that horizontal push-pull, and pointing it upwards. And then she realized, oh, this is very different. This is very different than I thought. I thought I had to win. I have to become the president, or I have to become the king, or the best manager. That's where Jesus said, my realm is not of your world. My kingdom is not in your world.
Larry, you just said Papa. Did you mean Yogananda, or did you mean that Mother didn't have that until Papa?
Well, I said Papa.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure. Papa was teaching her. The context I was in was, she was in the ashram, she was being taught by Papa, and she was realizing what.
But beyond that horizontal, you're implying that she didn't go above the horizontal until she was with Papa.
Yeah. Well, these are difficult things to understand. I don't know. You know,
because that doesn't sound correct.
Well, I mean, her knowledge of the horizontal plane is complete. You know, she's a human being and functioning highly in it. But did Master not teach her this way? And, when you go past the dual plane, then you leave the – it might be that this is the biggest shock that you have to deal with. Master is showing for the disciples who are ready for it and are not unable to be satisfied in this horizontal plane. These masters know these disciples. So they put them through something that will take them to where they really want to go, not knowing that it's in another dimension. It's in a right angle turn. It's not where you think you're going.
Larry, you know, as we meditate and we're lifted up, don't we sometimes rise above duality in that state, you know, temporarily, and then you come back to a human consciousness? But so I think, you know, we go back and forth, right? I mean, isn't that part of the path?
You know, when you have a lessening of the fierceness of duality, sure, it is going above duality, but it's not escaping from duality, right? People in the causal plane are still in duality, and they live a very exalted life. As we've talked about before, probably the angels represented in the Bible of seraphims probably are people in the causal plane. It's hard to think that they don't. They still have a horizontal plane existence of duality. And this is where saints are. Saints, too, Mother said. They're interested in good and evil. They're interested.
But, I mean, I'm thinking you're saying, you know, stuck on the horizontal plane, and it just doesn't bit more uplifted than that.
Not stuck on the horizontal plane, but aware and working in the horizontal direction. But there's a horizontal. My point is, even in the causal plane, which is definitely moving upward and definitely a higher spiritual state, even in the causal plane, there's duality. Because duality created all three planes.
So you're talking about Mother going from where she was to where Papa was.
Going over what Mother insisted on saying was going
over the top. Yeah.
And Meher Baba called it beyond the beyond. He's trying to, he says, when I speak, you don't understand. And when you speak, you're not speaking in the same way that the words that I'm using. Now, these are things to confuse the mind because the mind cannot comprehend it. Why waste your time? The guru really does say it's a waste of time to deal with the mind, but the soul can understand this, and that's what we're doing here. So look, there's a vertical aspect on all. Each time we move vertically and each time we move into the higher planes and we move and we come into the state of bliss. Bliss, as Papa says, is not dual. So this is beyond duality, and that's pointing in that direction. Doesn't mean that you've attained it, but there's levels of bliss. As we move in that direction, we feel that bliss. If we go to the astral plane, it's much easier to live and much easier to understand and not be confused and not be depressed and not be a human being on the physical plane. And then another, you know, Ramakrishna talked about going into the causal plane and meeting who later became Vivekananda. And he was such an exalted being in the causal plane that Ramakrishna begged him to come to the earth and brought him down. He wanted help. He needed disciples to follow. And look at the effect that Ramakrishna has had on the world through these disciples that he needed. But make no mistake, the causal plane is not got full God realization. Mother made us promise not to fall for mystery in between, or not to fall for the idea that we've made it when we haven't. Mother always said, I know and I know that I know. Well, you know, my son asked me one time about the spiritual path in that. So we were talking about different experiences and different mothers, and mostly he had just read the autobiography. And he asked me, how do you know when you're there? But how do you know when you're there? And I said, that is the conundrum. That's really the question. It's not like that's an incidental thing that will be, oh, well, I'll attain it and then I'll know. No, it is really, it's certainly struggling in that realm that gets us free. But it is.
If you think you're there, you're not. You have to know you're there.
There's no answer to this. So we have to just give up on a certain point.
One hand flapping.
Yeah.
It is rather mysterious with Mother, though, because we think of her as going through these tremendous experiences in 1958. And then she said that it took her 12 years or 15 years to become established.
Yeah.
And yet all through the 1960s in her talk, she would make statements that I have my oneness with God. And she certainly spoke as though from a fully realized state all through the 1960s. But it wasn't, as David said, he felt it was 1970 when she went over the top Sahaja Samadhi, and she herself said that it took her all that time to be able to operate with total balance. And so, like what Peter was saying, you have these uplifted experiences, and Mother certainly, I mean, she certainly had her God realization. But it took so long until she was fully established, like you said, where you cannot fall.
Right. I mean, I think that might be one hint as to how to look at it. Nirvikalpa Samadhi, I believe, the way Mother taught it anyway, is a state from which you can fall. And she said that Master talked about going into and out of it. That's the measure, as opposed to being established in Nirvikalpa.
And Swami Satchidananda as well.
Say again?
Satchidananda.
I see. Yes.
He said that
it should be effortless.
Yeah.
And he still had to put out some. He didn't say, I have to put out effort. He just said, I have not reached it yet because Papa said
it should be effortless. Yeah.
The one thing that's interesting, I mean, this is, it's very difficult for anybody to know where anybody is all along the line. And, you know, when Mother came to Papa, she said, when she came to the ashram, I have gone through most of the crucifixion. She was already talking about it in those terms.
Yeah.
We know that she had Nirvikalpa Samadhi at some point. And so I think she wasn't certainly expecting to go into that. She told us it was for, you know, mankind for her to be able to explain all of this. But I think she wasn't anticipating it, that it was going to be a 15 year process and that start in the way that it was. And I think that she was, one would think that perhaps she's just thinking, oh, there's the little, that rest of the way I've done all this other work. And then to have to do it all in such a way, all over, every step.
With and having her nose rubbed in each one too, at the lowest level. I know, so exactly right.
But she was already talking about that crucifixion experience when she came. So Master had taught her that.
Yeah, the result of Master's teachings got her to that point for sure. She certainly was in a place where she had come to those understandings, but biblically and otherwise, on her own. And she knew that this was the crucifixion discussion in the Bible was what we would call the Kundalini. So those are big, huge steps in understanding. And then God slowly explained more and more of what he meant with the biblical sense. You know, it's funny. I've read years ago a book called Guru by Swami Muktananda, who was from, I'm not sure where he was from, but his guru was from near where Papa, near Kerala, in fact, near Kanangan. So he's very close to Papa, physically, and they met once. But in the book Guru, he talks a lot about very technical terms, and it's such an intellectual level of knowledge that people have of these higher states, that there are so many miraculous things that people can do from individual states. It's such a house of mirrors, room of mirrors, and it is such. In other words, I don't mean to disparage people, because I always insist that Sri Yukteswar taught he brought forth stuff that are necessary for the astral, for the people trying to get into the astral plane from this plane, but trying to get realization. But as an intellectual, the book Holy Science has a very intellectual component, and it's very specific, it's very technical. So what's in the book Guru is even more exacting, in which he's talking about going through these experiences with certain nerves and certain organs in the body vibrating in certain ways, and that this means this and this means that. And it's a fascinating book, no doubt. But at the same time, I don't feel drawn to it, because mothers are, I feel, sufficient. And I, you can see that if you just get given realization, that you wouldn't really need to do anything else. But when you choose back to come back to this world in a sense of compassion, as Mother did, then you get you have to please every aspect of the disciples. There are some disciples who won't even start until they read. Myself, anyway, I didn't, until I read the autobiography, I had no interest in God or religion or anything. Completely lost to me. And I thought that it had nothing to offer. But by appealing to the things that he did in the way that he did, I then could see that the door opened. It really did. So, Mother's doing a similar thing. She's doing something for the Christian world, I'm convinced, that will make sense to them. That will connect with some people. And these are people who are probably maybe not even born yet. There's much work to do in this Christian world, and some of us are coming back to help with it. I love what Mother said, that Master, and I think it was Master, claimed that he would, but I wasn't sure if Mother knew it or if Master told her that he would come back in about 900 years. And Mother said that she would come with him. She was, wherever he would go, she would be glad to go with him. Some of us will come back sooner than that. There's this work to do. By the way, I just want to, maybe I'll put a link in the, I'll send it out in an email to the Crossmodus friends. It's such a tremendous explanation of reincarnation. It's considered the best example or best case ever to be made on reincarnation. A young boy who from the age of 1 and 2 was able to slowly explain what in the world was going on with him. And he died in an airplane in 1945, during the war in the Pacific. And he came back immediately within a few years of that, and still had these memories so strong that he knew people's names. But it's more dramatic than that. There's plenty of other stories similar to this, but nothing as complete as this. That simply he could not have known, this young boy could not have known these things without reincarnation as an explanation, or something like reincarnation, because it fits the bill rather well. And so I think I'll send it around. So some people do come back quite soon afterward, for God knows what reasons. No, normally it's quite hundreds of years, from what Mother said. She said that people sleep a lot. They don't really wake in the astral plane. They don't They don't have the tools. They don't have the understanding, the state of consciousness to understand it. So that's earthbound souls, or we think of as ghosts, but there are many earthbound souls in their consciousness. Doesn't mean that they walk around on the earth, but their focus is on the earth.
Is that why they say rest in peace? Mm-hmm. Because you said they're sleeping a lot on the one plane.
That's very good, yeah. That's true. That's very nice. Yeah. Well, it's often seen as a rest, as a relaxation. You know, people say, you know, I'm going to be with the Father. I'm going to be with Jesus. See, I much prefer to talk of Father. I love Master's use of many mansions, or many mansions in my Father's kingdom, and Jesus did, but the Master said it, similarly used the Father that way. But I think with the Christians, they want that intimate relationship with a personality, a person, Jesus. And they get to imagine him in their own way. And there's nothing wrong with any of that, because this is what lifts you. It doesn't have to make sense in this plane. So much underground or hidden from view on what souls are doing here.
Thought came to me, this week in meditation about the idea of the impersonal God and the personal God, and wondering if all the personal God is different masters.
Yeah, that's, well, so let's talk about one thing. And see if that comports with what you're saying. And that is, you know, when David went to live, because I think King Saul was going after him, I remember the details, but he left Israel and went to the Philistines and lived with them for a while. During that time, he always felt that he'd left the land of his God.
Right.
Left God's presence. That is a tribal notion. That's a notion of a tribal God.
Yeah.
But, certainly,
And that they carried the Ark of the Covenant that contained God, their God.
Well, I'm not,
the Ark.
I'm not sure that they said that. They said it's a place where, I'll be corrected on this gladly, but
yeah.
It's an instrument of power. It's an instrument, it was a tool, it was an instrument of some sort.
Yeah.
And God used
it. Because it contained, at least that's some explanations of, you know, some understanding.
The only thing that comes to my mind is that, you know, in the temple, there's the Holy of Holies.
Yeah.
That is where, that's where God touched the earth in the Jewish teaching, from what I understand of theirs. And I don't understand at the higher levels of their teachings. But it's interesting too, isn't it, that the Ark of the Covenant was put there.
Mm-hmm.
In that temple. Was it not in the Holy of Holies? Must have been interesting and odd to have lost such a thing as the Ark of the Covenant when it was found missing. How can you recover from such things? And the Jews did many times. They were invaded, taken captive, spread to the four winds, down into the Nile, into Elephantine Island, into Ethiopia perhaps. And God brings them back together, the scattered sheep. What a tremendous story in the Bible. Mother was something else, wasn't she?
Is.
Thank you, Jill.
That just came up in something. It was written somewhere. Either David was saying it or mother was saying it about Master. I can't remember where I saw it or heard it.
Well, of course they are. It's plural. It's present tense, isn't it?
It was David's writing about mother. Is. I don't remember where I just read it, though.
Nice.
Might have been in silence.
Sorry, Joe.
Oh, go ahead. It was something to the effect of mother's work is, not mother's work was the proper terminology. Go ahead, Mira. Sorry.
I was just thinking this whole time that we have this, you know, beautiful synthesis of mother's talks on the experience of the actual crucifixion. And coming into being, we have a description of the support, the help that put her into the experience. And what is left is the stories that set her on the path. It's kind of like working backwards. And that there's, I think, this beautiful space for the stories, the letters between she and Master, the time spent with Master that put her on this path that led her to Papa, that led her into these final experiences, and connect all the dots of her just phenomenal life.
And we're doing prequels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like Tolkien. Now it's time to write the Silmarillion.
Exactly. That's next.
In some ways, David's played that role.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He demonstrated that what mother was teaching was both doable and accurate. Well, you know, let's say the closing prayer. Let's just say it all together. I think with the lagging speakers and microphones, it's hard to do a call and response. So let's say the closing prayer is getting late. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother. I feel the wonder.
The wonder and the beauty.
Thy glorious presence. In every part of my being. My heart is bursting with
love to thee.
My needle and adoration to thy feet. And to surrender myself to thee. I feel the power of thy perfection surging in every cell of my body. My mind
and my intelligence
are radiant
with thy healing light.
My soul is filled
with ecstasy and bliss.
My
communion with thee.
I and my Father
are
one. Blessed Spirit,
I am He.
Peace.
Bless. Amen.